Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 112 of the Alexis Help podcast. And I have, first of all, a vital piece of housekeeping and a mea culpa. Of course, I said episode 111, and that was the name of the single engine fighter which lost out to the
We've had so many complaints about this.
Oh, I know, the BF-109 in the 1935 competition for Luftwaffe. And of course, I was right, the Heinkel 111 was a bomber, and the single engine fighter which lost out to the BF-109 was in fact the Heinkel 112, which is this episode. But I can only apologize the one lunatic who really is interested in this apart from me. So hello, Robin Ince.
I presume that's the one person who listens, not because of your acting or comedy career, but because you were the Daily Telegraph motoring correspondent.
Yeah.
So that's why I listen to Alexi, and it's these kind of engineering details, which is why he lost that job eventually.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It's a broad spread of, you know, I don't think anybody else has quite ever got my demographic, which is, you know, Marxists and angry left-wingers and people interested in tanks and ammunition.
We often get accused of having not done our research on the topics we discuss, but who would have thought it would have been your knowledge of military machinery that actually got us caught out.
Finally did for us. Anyway, as I say, I can only apologize to everybody for that terrible, terrible mistake.
Okay,
it makes you feel the benefit of how many mistakes you've got away with over 110 episodes.
Yeah, yes, that's true. Yeah, but you know, it's always, you know, it's always a sense, isn't it, that eventually you're going to get caught out, you know. There isn't
an Ofcom for podcasting, and it would be a good and a bad thing if that was the case, because podcasting is such a liberal, like free, liberated medium that people, it's such a beautiful thing that people can do whatever they want, but it's also such a horrifying thing that people can do whatever they want with it. And maybe some sort of regulation service, we'd get fucked in it as much as all the, you know, the Trumpist right wing.
Oh, I don't think they'd get fucked in it at all. I think we've watched that. That there's two very different sets of rules in terms of understanding how turning the wheel of a car to get out of a situation can be understood. And it's like, you know, so I think you would be destroyed almost instantaneously. Mark Steele would have to renege on his Trotskyist beliefs and swear allegiance to, you know, some right-wing despot. There would be nothing left.
Yeah, so, which we've seen. Indeed, we've seen how
POFCOM, I think
that works in the where the Ofcom allows the Jewish Chronicle to print lies constantly and is never, you know, it's never criticised really.
I did find it amazing when I've forgotten his name now, and I think I do that deliberately. The journalist in the Jewish Chronicle who was saying what a great person Nigel Farage was.
And probably Lee Harpin.
And oh man, it was just, it's that bit of going, how can you not see, and why do you refuse to see that these are the very people that in the 1930s would have not been on the right side on Cable Street?
yeah. Absolutely. Anyway.
Have we even introduced him yet?
Yeah, no, this is my guest today is a comedian and broadcaster, Robin Ince, the man who Linda, my wife, angrily denounces as the terrible individual who lured me back into the horrific world of stand-up, really.
You know, but so to be denounced by Linda feels like to be denounced by, you know, someone who's had at least a great big statue in the middle of Leningrad. You know, that's kind of, to be denounced by her, I think, may well be the only eulogy that I get.
But she thought we were free and clear of this kind of Piero nonsense. I was a serious writer and And then you dragged me back in with your, and sort of it was like, it was a gradual thing, wasn't it? First of all, you dragged me back in with your chaotic book readings, and I thought, well, I can do
this. that was a classic lineup, because that had the epidemiologist Ben Goldacron, a bluegrass band, and someone who'd written a book about the ex-rental market VHSs.
Right.
you slid in to that very, very easily, I think. And then the next one was, we were doing a benefit for a library that the council were trying to close.
That's right.
In a school gym, and it was a library which Mark Twain had visited, and it had this very kind of, you know, rich history to it. And in fact, what the council did, I think, is one day they realised that everyone was demonstrating for keeping the library open, which meant that no one was guarding the library, and that's when they snuck in. I used to talk a lot about, because it was that evening there was that beautiful moment where. You had, because I think the first two gigs we did, I always say you were like doing a conversation at a book festival.
Yeah.
You know, the different stories of that. And then it was right at the end that a bloke shouted out at you and you leapt up in the air and started going, that's right, that's right, that's right. Mm-hmm. You're looking to Lexi Sale. And that's when I looked at Linda and the blood drained from my face.
Yeah. And, oh, God, he's back.
Yeah. Well, as I've often said, you know, but, of course, Alexis Sale always says that Stuart Lee was the one who revived his career, because Stuart Lee is far better known and Alexis Sale is a very shallow Marxist.
Yeah, very, yeah.
God, you know him so well.
But you enjoyed it when you came back, didn't you?
Well, it's interesting. When... particularly when I did, was it Nine Carols for that Christmas thing? And I had with me my friend Oscar Zarate, who's very, I think partly because he's very emotionally sensitive, Oscar, the Argentinian, but also full-blood Guarani Indian. And he said, when we were backstage, he said, you were running up and down the stairs. You were so happy. You were so, and it was that I realized being backstage at that show, being amongst comedians, I felt like, you know, I felt like I was where I should be, really. The joy of being amongst other comics was something that I hadn't realized. That, you know, being in a green room at Cheltenham with Julian Barnes and, you know, Nagoni Chigedi Azice, you know, it's all well and good. But they're not like swapping the one-liners, are they, really, you know?
Quick, everyone hide. Here comes Rosie Boycott. And I do think that also because of the way that we've always put together those shows, they are people who are their love of comedy as opposed to their need for show business.
Yeah.
Is the main thing. You know, I mean, you've been backstage there as well, you know, this last year, you know, and I think that thing of just having everyone where they really care. And it is, and I should say for the, I mean, I suppose most people listening probably know Oscar Zarate's work, but I mean, he's not only obviously Jeffrey the Tube Train and the fat comedian, but his work, like his you know, Dr. Faustus and also Small Killing with Alan Moore as well. He's an artist that I felt quite in awe when he was there. And I think that's another thing, which is I would imagine, you know, backstage at Michael McIntyre's Comedy Roadshow, most people won't believe that Oscar Zarate is here. But, you know, backstage there, it's like, oh, my God, I've read all of his books.
Yeah, currently in Argentina.
It was an interesting atmosphere backstage at Nine Carols, because I did it this last one. It was not just, it's not your typical comedy green room. It's lots of intellectuals and writers and artists and lecturers. And I think I followed someone who did a short lecture on Bones. I've never experienced that before. But somehow I think the comedians did kind of gravitate towards each other somewhat in the green room. But it was such a fascinating, brilliant night. Did you come up with Nine Carols? Was that your invention?
Yeah, it was. But I was on I was on some late night debate show or something on ITV, and with Vanessa Feltz and other members of the contemporary Bloomsbury set, and it was about why are they trying to ban Christmas, which is not what I was told the debate was going to be. And I got so, and Stephen Green, who was a very unpleasant man from an organization called Christian Voice, who did a lot of the work to try and get Jerry Springer the Opera banned and would have greatly helped the number of death threats that Stuart Lee got and all of that kind of thing, was on it. And of course, he wasn't really a representative of Christians at all either. He was someone who was an agitator. And I got so frustrated with all, like Vanessa Feltz told this story where she said, someone rang up my show the other day and they said in the nativity play, their son had to play a lobster. And then later on, someone said, that's a scene from Love Actually. That's not, And so I was so frustrated with this whole kind of, oh, why do atheists all hate Christmas and everything? And I thought, and I kept saying, I don't. I like it. I like having a break. I like it. It's nice. And so that's why I started doing, originally it was called Nine Lessons of Carols for Godless People. And then because I also realised a lot of atheists were assholes as well, I just made it for curious people to make it more accessible.
All right.
Nice. That got me back in, and then I watched Stuart with the last of 1981 show, which was where I first did stand up again after 17 years. So he is culpable as well, but Linda lets him off.
Yeah, he lets something about again, you because she can get him into he can get her into all those free jazz gigs that she loves.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's why she stays tight with Stuart, but you can offer her nothing. What happened to Ben Goldacre? I forgot.
I think he's just doing like real work now.
Proper science.
He did that really great thing, which was All Trials, I think it was called, which was to say that, you know, a lot of organizations actually cherry pick the trials that get released. So it can look like, you know, certain pharmaceuticals or whatever it might be. Oh, these results are great. And so he did a lot of stuff organization on that. And I think now he works in Oxford kind of in various different organizations to try and make many of these worlds more transparent and more kind of comfortable.
Because he did have that fascinating column in the Guardian for a while around about then, didn't he, really? That kind of viewpoint is sadly missing now. So I suppose...
I think one of the reasons that the Guardian lost a lot of its science columnists was because they got rid of all of them because they kept having to write columns about how their other columnists were writing total shit. And so it was like, well, which do we get rid of? The people who are selling snake oil or these ghastly scientists? I'll tell you what, a lot of people are reading the snake oil shit, so let's go with that.
That's what I remember, because a lot of people think that science correspondents, like at the Daily Mail, is somebody with a science background that will have gone to MIT and done done graduate work in engineering or molecular science. Of course, they're not. They're just idiot journalists who were formerly 3 AM girls or whatever who've now been bounced over to the science beat, and they have no science background whatsoever, really.
Yeah, well, that's why so often it is. It's the first three lines of a press release rather than everything that then remains below it in the same way as, you know, the number of it's like when you look at the reports of a lot of trials and stuff now and you see the results and you go, oh, they've literally only taken one. I mean, we see that a lot with those trials over like kind of a lot of the different trans issues where they'll say this was a partial victory for this person who was you know, against the trans community. And then you actually go, oh, but they were found to have lost 9 out of 10 of the things that they, but the 1 out of 10 means that actually they have the greatest victory.
Yeah. No, you get a lot of that with
the Zionists as well.
Zionists as well, don't you really?
Yeah. I think those are really good lessons. I mean, like, that was one of the things is when I got a lot of the abuse that I would get when I kind of spoke up on, you know, to be supportive towards, you know, the trans community and trans issues, it's exactly the same techniques. So the first thing that you're told is that you hate women. In the same way that the first thing you're told if you bring up anything that's happening in Gaza is, oh, well, you must be anti-Semitic. And, of course, to the liberal heart, that's a terrible, you know, you go, but I'm not, but. And the fact that even you and Michael Rosen and Miriam, my God, you know, and again, you have exactly the same thing, which is, you know, all the women that I work with, you know, with Josie Long and with Grace Petrie and all this, they are all also trans allies. So that means they're the wrong women. So they kind of don't really count.
The wrong kind of women. So you've been having, so, there's two things. We were talking before we came on air, as it were, about, well, we were talking about you and Ricky Gervais. And then you were leaving the BBC, I suppose, leaving the BBC or leaving
Infinite Monkey Cage.
Your science at Infinite Monkey Cage, which I've been on. You had me on, you were kind enough to have me on a couple of times. And I think you know, the meaning of you turn to out of their depth in the dictionary, you would be me, really. I did find myself, you and Brian Cox going, you know, the cross crocodilation of the photon. diameter, and I'm, I get it, I've got it. What about the German Pfizer from the...
That's the only time we've ever had a complaint. Someone said I was enjoying the quantum indeterminacy episode until the misinformation about the engine that was brought in by
German Pfizer procurement,
which was both irrelevant and wrong.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, irrelevant and wrong. I like that as a slogan for our show.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. You said you were. I mean, it's funny. I mean, we were, again, I mean, I was, I couldn't fucking believe it. I have already, I think, mentioned it on the podcast that they gave the Golden Globes for best stand-up to Ricky Gervais's Netflix special. I have to say, Ricky Gervais has never been anything but nice to me, but that, yeah. Anyway, but
we were discussing that last week.
Yeah,
and then I remembered that when I was young and I went to see him live, and I saw you supporting him, and we thought, yeah, we'd get your point of view on him and like what happened with that relationship.
Yeah, it was,
and that. I don't know if this has been something you've talked about.
No, I mean, the one thing I talked about ages ago, and it was like in about a 7-hour podcast, one of those ones where, and I very briefly mentioned that I realized the older I got that we very much had the relationship of kind of what he does really like to bully people, which he would just see as jovial fun. But of course, as we know, that might not be how. And so he's very good at picking people like me, who, or certainly the way I was for most of my life, which who has a level of anxiety, because then you can feed off watching someone, you know, crumble a bit. And I talked about it very casually, and I just said, you know, I just kind of look back and I realised that it was quite a bullying relationship. And everyone else joins in. That's the thing, is because he's the one who's, you know, keeping everyone employed. So it was always, you know, the tour manager and all those things. And there was one guy who I still see every now and again, who I think was assistant on the lighting. And he was the only one who said, I'm not joining in. This is really nasty. And every time I see him, I think, you're a really good person, because you didn't get caught up in this Lord of the Flies situation. But I talked about it very casually. And then about 7 months later, the press were looking for something. I think someone had said that they'd been Zeke-hiling outside a synagogue or whatever, because they were doing it because Ricky Gervais is so cool and it seemed like an edgy thing to do. It was something like that. And so obviously the papers then went, where can we find the negative stories? Where, and they found this old podcast from like the beginning of the year. And it was amazing just to see how cross people get. I mean, it's one of those things of diehard atheists, is they really like being a god themselves, which is, I think, why they don't like the idea of a Christian god, is because it gets in the way of their own deification. And seeing his fans just, you know, the attacks, and now I just don't even, you know, I don't bother looking at it. And you always get this thing, you're just bitter. I have a really nice life, and I work with people that I really like working with, and I get to meet amazing, well, people like Oscar Zaratti, of course, you know, that kind of thing. And we never had a big falling out, because it just never – I did write a thing about 3 or 4 years ago. I'd started to – again, this was on the kind of his anti-trans jokes, which I thought were lazy and really nasty. I think if you put them – if you imagined them as racist jokes from the 1970s, these were really full on and very, very vicious to already a community that is tremendously dehumanized and finds it, you know, going through the – well, I always think it was very revealing that he used to do a load of stuff about Dawn French, kind of fat jokes. But he didn't do them when Richard Curtis was in. And I think that says a lot about how edgy you are as a comedian. I know that whenever, like, I know that when Douglas Hurd has ever been in your audience, Alexei, you never got the anti
a soft pedal on the
I don't know why Hurd keeps coming back. He loves it, but the I just wrote a piece because I thought so many people when they're under attack think, well, I imagine that because Robin worked with Ricky, he would also hold these things. And I just wrote a very gentle piece saying that I think when you've got a platform that big, you do have to think about how you're using your words and the effect they may have on people. And it's not good enough just to say, well, it's just a joke, because it's just a joke to you, but it's not to those people who now feel further dehumanized and other people feel they can take the piss more. Such a gentle piece. And then we just never spoke again, because like a lot of free speech people, one of the things is you're not allowed to have any free speech about them. You know, which is what we see in the Trumpist thing. So that was, and then now I just find it really amazing that I didn't watch his last stand-up. I saw a little bit of his last stand-up special, which I think is mainly about, hasn't everyone got ADHD now, folks?
Yeah.
And again, that seems to me to something that I could overhear in a reasonably unimpressive pub.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't mean from an act. I literally mean just, oh, look, there's some men going, well, everyone's going nowadays, don't they?
That's exactly what he goes for, is that kind of energy. Because that's his audience as well. They're like easy to impress, and they just want to hear someone who they would meet down the pub speaking the same way freely and without care. And, I'm so lucky I dodged that bullet. Like, because I was a fan as a teenager. You know, The Office was so big, and then everyone was, all eyes were on him, and you're watching his stand up, and you're like, what's he going to do next? And extras and all that shit. And I found it, his edgy stuff was really funny because I was a child. And, you know, it was fun to like say things that were inappropriate and you shouldn't say it in public and all this stuff. And I'm so glad I grew out of that. I'm so lucky that I didn't take that on as my humor. Like, I still like to be provocative or say something that might put someone for a moment think, oh, wait, is that edgy? Oh, no, wait, I actually just understood what he said. And that's actually not a bad thing. But he just says the awful thing out loud and proud. And it's, I'm just, I feel very, like I dodged a bullet that I didn't carry on enjoying that.
Well, I think if your edgy comedy could be sold on to Richard Littlejohn if he's unable to write a column that week, then it's not very edgy. If it's something that is the kind of opinion that is across the media, in the Mail and the Express and the Times and the then who are you being edgy to? You're not really. And I remember you saying years ago, Lexi, about when you sometimes had jokes on Americans and people would say, oh, well, you don't pick on that group, but you do. And you said, well, it is about the positions of power.
Yeah.
And I think that always remained with me. And I know I could probably go back only a few years and there's an enormous number of jokes that I wouldn't do now because I'm learning all the time.
Yeah.
And hopefully the older you get, the more empathy. Like, do you know Tom Shakespeare? I don't know if you met him on the night you did 9 lessons.
I feel like I don't, I'm not sure.
Tom's
great. Name's familiar.
At least half of it. His dad was called Will as well, which is just,
really?
Don't do that. But he's got a form, I forget exactly what it is, but it's a form of dwarfism. And in the book Others, which is a fantastic collection of people talking about what it is to be othered, to be on the outside. And he was talking about the way that he can't really go out on a Friday night because people might suddenly just grab him and lift him up.
I've seen him that on a bar. Happening on the street,
He said, you know, he's had cars stop, someone leap out, point at him and laugh and then get back in.
Yeah.
And I remember reading that and just thinking, this is what we have to be very aware of, which is there are so many things to attack in the world, but during the rise of fascism, extremism, covering up abuse, all those things, that seems to me to be a more interesting topic to go to than hasn't everyone neurodivergent now?
Yeah.
That was a whole Gervais sketch at one point as well, was picking up the little person. And
really? Oh, yeah, I suppose that is. Oh, God, I hadn't even thought of that. Yeah, Life's Too Short. That kind of was.
Oh, God.
Do you know what? That was like hearing King Lear come on at the end carrying.
All right, we've given that prick enough oxygen. I've just been, I was looking at your blog, Robin, and there was an article from bloody hell, 2014, titled, "If Alexei Sale Pulls a Knife, You Pull a Gun," said Bobby Hall, polishing his Colt. Any memories of writing that?
No, what was that from?
It's from your WordPress blog.
Oh, God.
And it begins,
a long time ago.
In 1979, there was a schism where the end of the pier crashed into the bar of the Marxist art school and the streets ran red with the dye.
Is it Bobby Hall or Bobby Ball?
Bobby Ball.
Oh, so. That's right then. Yeah, no, I presume that was just, yeah, thinking about the... because I do find it really interesting that because there are so many brilliant comics now, a lot of them not getting that much exposure. But, like, I don't know, have either of you seen Hannah Platt?
Oh, no.
She's great. She's really – Hannah Platt, Katrina Dowden, who did a whole show about, I think, medieval saints. And it was funny and it was – you know what I mean? You watch these and you think all of that world – that the way of using alternative comedy to talk about something bigger than, you know, mother-in-law jokes, whatever it might be. It's all there, but it is now. There are also a lot of Mike and Bernie Winters kind of, you know, the 21st century's version.
Come back. I failed to eradicate him. I will just say one thing about Ricky Gervais. His existence must really, his success must really, really upset Ben Elton. Because Ricky is what Ben would like to be, but hasn't quite navigated the.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, my God. Because
I think, I don't know, I think he's doing a similar thing, isn't it? But in much smaller venues. Oh, God, I'm so petty.
Here's the
feud from 45 years
ago. Here's the bitter one.
Yes, who's the bitter one, really?
But still, that Rod Stewart show is unforgivable. So
that is Rod Stewart, who I'd not realised that he actually was promoting Enoch Powell even before Eric Clapton.
Yeah, he's very, very right wing. Yeah. I mean, you know, why wouldn't he be? Really, there's no, you know.
I always remember John Peel saying that he was the tightest man he'd ever known. He said, "You really? Get ears in and you put them down, and." Then you'd all finish your pints and you'd just wait, thinking if we wait long enough, Rod might go, well, it must be my round. And then eventually you'd give up and you go, oh, do you want another one? Yeah, I'll have a pint. Oh, can you get me a short as well? I'll have a whiskey. And I did get, in fact, just after we did an event at Latitude Festival, I don't know if you remember this, actually, that I was walking off stage. You were the final event I was doing. And the stage manager ran up to me and went, oh, my God, the bloke who was meant to be interviewing Irvin Welsh has run away. Is there any chance you can interview him right now? And so literally I turned around as you walked off with Irvin Welsh and went, walked on stage and said, Irvin, as you know, I've not read your new novel, but we'll just see what happens. But the guy said to me, the stage manager said, there's 500 quid and a bottle of whiskey in it for you. Which, of course, doubled my fee for the weekend. So I was like, I'll do it. And it ended up being the Rod Stewart whiskey.
Oh,
which is there's a brand of whiskey that's kind of, you know, has a copy of Rod Stewart's signature on the side.
Right.
And I can tell you that, yeah, it's not an impressive whiskey on any level.
I'm not a connoisseur, but.
You wouldn't need to be a connoisseur. I think you would, even with a palate that is ignorant of the many whiskies of the world, you would.
It's called Wolfie's Whiskey, serving up Scottish whiskey with a rock and roll edge.
Yeah.
Fucking hell. didn't we? I think we drove back together, didn't we, from Suffolk that night? I think I came with you and your car.
Oh, yeah, you did. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was trapped in, I don't know what I thought I was going to do, how I thought I was going to get back.
That's always what worries me about festivals. I know you've done Glastonbury a few times recently, haven't you?
Yeah.
And the first thing I think of when I get to Glastonbury is not who am I going to go and see. I think, how am I going to get away again?
Yeah. Well, Roland Rivron lives quite nearby, so you can go and you can always make your way to Roland Rivron's house. You can ask a passing farmer flagged them down, said, take me to Roland Rivron's house. That's where I stayed. Like. So take me to Dr. What was his character called? Dr.
Martin Scrote.
Scrote, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
They were great. I really do feel sad that those kind of things don't exist now. I was, you know, Jacko Jackzit, don't you?
I feel like no.
Jacko used to be in Raw Sex. And
in Raw Sex?
Yeah, he would play the occasional Lothario Spaniard. That,
right. Because mostly it was Simon and Roland, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he would come on, and Jacko is actually, he played on Nigel Planer's Neil's Heavy Concept album, and he's a member of King Crimson now and all that stuff. And he says he just remembers in the 80s and early 90s being in these kind of drinking clubs and hearing Roland Rivron just talking shit and coming up with the maddest ideas, like, what if I did a chat show just floating in the Thames and we've all got kind of, and I'll just be there bobbing up and down with Wendy James. And you think, well, that was a mad idea. And then he said you'd go back home a month later and you turn on the TV at 2 in the morning and there would be Roland just bobbing in the Thames with Wendy James.
Yes. Channel 4 would make it. Yeah. those were the days.
His book is fantastic.
Well, how the fuck did I get here?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he's an interesting, you know, Roland is a, which maybe you should get him on, really, because he's an interesting.
I just always found him so, the moment that I loved Raw Sex. I thought
they were
one of the first shows I ever saw in Edinburgh when I was 18 was Raw Sex. And Kathy Burke was in that at that point as well. And Jacko was in it. And then when Roland used to do those things like the Bunker Show and stuff, late night ITV.
I was on that,
I absolutely, there was something about him that he was just, and I met him once. I met him back. I had a friend whose brother did all the legal stuff for Bad News, the comic strip band.
And I imagine there was a lot.
Yeah. And I went to see him at Hammersmith Apollo, and then he got us tickets to the after show in this pub around the corner. And of course, as an 18-year-old, I was in awe. You know, there's Rick over there, there's Dawn over there, there's, you know. But the person I got talking to was Roland, who just put up with two, you know, 18-year-olds.
Yeah.
Who were just, and he was just, and he kept doing impressions of Ben Elton, actually.
Yeah.
He said, just say anything you want. Say, you know, just so we'd say, I don't know, he'd say Ben Elton's routine on hats, but then everyone's got a hat. He's got a hat. She's got a hat. Who's got a hat? He hasn't got a hat. Why hasn't he got a hat? And he would just do this for about an hour. It was one of the greatest nights of my life. And I thought the fact that, you know, I've always had a tremendous amount of respect to people who don't have any front. You know, I always liked the fact that bit where you could just talk to everyone just in a normal way. And not carry with you those kind of, you know, the golden orbs of show business.
Yeah. 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 No, I agree. It's
absolutely.
It's the happiest of all of us, I think. Really. So now you were in the papers again for quitting controversial. And everybody noticed that through this entire interview, I've been eating one almond croissant, which comes from a local croissanterie called Au Pain de Papy. I thought it'd be on their bag, but it's not. If you're ever in the King's Cross area and you want it's not cheap, but if you want an almond croissant that'll last you through an entire podcast, then I recommend Au Pain de Papy. Just putting that in there.
Can I just say that some of these podcasts, they're really overt in the way that they show their sponsor, but the subtlety of you showing your sponsor throughout the podcast just by picking a little bit and every now and again going, I think the money they pay you is well earned.
Oh, I thought I got away with it as well, but
we will never have a sponsor on this show. We rely purely on the support of our good-hearted listeners who visit patreon.com/AlexisSale podcast. Thanks for the cue up there, Robin. Go to patreon.com/AlexisSale podcast.
Aye, papi.
And chuck us a few quid a month and you will help keep the wheels a turning and keeping this show moving forward and upwards, and you get to see full video episodes and other exclusive content on that Patreon website. One last time, it's patreon.com/AlexisSale podcast. Your blog goes on here, Robin. It says Alexis Sale looked Jimmy Tarbuck square in the eye and bit the tip off his nose. All mainstream comedians were sent to a Blackpool gulag. So it looks like you've done this little bit of creative writing here, Robin.
God, I didn't. Do you know what? It's funny because I write all the time and I'm always just making. It's like I've even done that thing. I don't know if either of you have ever had that bit where you did something on stage and someone comes up to you after and said, I really enjoyed that bit about the kimono and the dachshund. And you go, oh, I don't think that was me. And then when it was for about 8 minutes, that moment where you just get taken over by, but it's such an immediate thing.
Yes, it belongs to that moment. I often find that
with writing. When sometimes people will send a couple of lines from a book that I've written and say, oh, I really enjoyed this. And then I'll think, well, who wrote that? And they go, it's in your book. And I go, whoever does my books, which is me, obviously, that's sometimes they do an all right job.
I remember 1 year ago, me and Lisa and Rick, I think, tried to do a fan quiz about the Young Ones and couldn't get any of the answers right.
Well, I still live with the pain of forgetting Bacon Sandwich, which is the name, obviously, of the pig mascot in Bambi. When I did the Young Ones as my celebrity mastermind.
Really?
Subject. Oh, shit.
Yeah, I'd originally said I'd like to do Kurt Vonnegut, and they went, ah, it takes too much research, can't be bothered. And then I said Rick Mayall, and they said, well, there isn't an official biography. I was like, well, you don't need an official biography to go through his IMDb page or whatever. And so eventually we whittled it down to the Young Ones, and I watched 12 episodes, probably about 10 times, literally noting down, like, posters that were behind the fridge, thinking that's what John Humphreys was going to ask. And by really overdoing the revision, I forgot little details like Bacon Sandwich. And much like you with some of your technological aviation errors, my failure to remember Bacon Sandwich was...
So tell us about your late... Well, tell us about what you're up to generally, but partly...
I'm writing a book about empathy at the moment, and that's quite an interesting. I wrote a poem a while ago called Weapons of Empathy because I was thinking about how much. I mean, comedy played its part in empathy. You know, when I first got into alternative comedy, there was a lot of stuff that I was being introduced to, and in the same way where, you know, things like the specials. I look back now and I think, here was I, a middle-class home counties kid, and then I start listening to the specials. And that was, in much the same way as some of alternative comedy was, this was like an education in the world, and it led to lots of – that's what I love about, you know, really good comedy to me very often. You think, where did I first hear about that? And it was just a name that was just dropped in the middle of a routine or whatever, but if you're really fascinated. Mm. And so I was thinking about how important a lot of the kind of art and music has been for me in terms of empathy. And then, of course, because I think – the reason that I had to resign from the Infinite Monkey Cage was over an empathy situation. Because basically I just...
What happened then?
I was putting out on social media was considered incendiary. And I really thought it was humanitarian. I didn't see, like, saying things that were negative about Donald Trump or positive about trans community or other LGBT stuff, or, you know, even mentioning, because at one point I mentioned some of the, when they had that, you remember they projected Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein on the side of Windsor Castle? I presume that was led by Donald Trump. And all I did was I just put up a thing on my Blue Sky saying, unfortunately, it's always been very easy for paedophiles to get into this castle. And then I just mentioned that, you know, Prince Charles, King Charles, whatever he is, that he, you know, three of his closest people.
Yeah, there's a very good what's his name,
Lord Mountbatten.
Yeah, but Craig Murray did a very good piece on that. Yeah, how all is, yeah, Mountbatten, Wilfred Thesiger,
Lawrence Van der Post.
Lawrence Van der Post. Maybe I'm bad mouthing Wilfred.
I think Lawrence Van der Post. I don't know if it was, but I think it was Lawrence Van der Post.
Who, yeah, you're right.
14-year-old pregnant when he was 46 and meant to be escorting her to ballet school, I think. And then Peter Ball, who I think was Bishop of Lewis or something like that. And he and to me, that should not be considered to, well, that's very bad, and this affects our journalistic integrity. One, I'm not a journalist, and two, I think integrity, especially when we watch, you know, watching what's going on around Epstein. And there's a great book which I recommend to everyone who's listening to this. Lucia Osborne Crowley wrote a book called The Lasting Harm. She went to the Ghislaine Maxwell trial every single day. She made sure she was one of the four press people to actually get into the room of the trial. She would stand in the freezing cold at 2 a.m. to make sure she got in. Jeez. She's now friends with many of the people who were victims. Right. And I read books like that, and I think, no, this is the whole problem, isn't it? Which go, well, I mean, there are rumours, aren't there? But these things aren't rumours.
No.
And I didn't think that it was, but I think that's the bit, isn't it, which is the Overton window swung so much that actually just mentioning the proximity of abusers, rapists, et cetera, to power is considered to be the kind of thing that only the maddest of, kind of Trotskyists would do.
Well, they paint it that way, don't they? And it was the producers of the BBC who were giving you earache about it.
There were a couple of executives, and I think it was, I think it probably ran a bit deeper as well, because it was the first time that I mentioned, one of the first times I think I brought up, all I did was I'd mentioned that I saw that the Graham Linehan was getting, you know, all this praise for being a great feminist. And I was thinking of the women that I knew who were great feminists, very often at cost to their own career for what they stood up for. Again, people like Josie and Grace Petrie, and then also people like Carrie Ad Lloyd as well. And they were all getting relentlessly bullied and abused for saying positive things and trying to be positive towards the trans community. And that was coming from Linehan. I thought, how can he be a great feminist if he attacks any woman who doesn't agree with him? And in fact, a friend of mine said to me, you've probably forgotten, but when he was campaigning for abortion rights, he would very often come to various feminists and say, by the way, you're doing it all wrong. I'll explain how you can do it better as a man. And so that was all I put up. And then that, I thought, oh, that was just, you know, it's only a mild thing I just put up. And I didn't even use his name. I just said, I think it's a bit weird that someone's being celebrated as a feminist when they attack any woman who doesn't agree with them. And I thought, oh, that's, oh, no one's really even replied, forgetting I'd turned off being able to see the replies. And then a day later, I started getting those messages which were going, really sorry to see what's going on. And I was like, huh? And then I found out that I was a very popular figure on Twitter. And I think from that point onwards, it was really focused on, because anti-trans people would write into the BBC and say that I shouldn't be allowed to present a science show because I didn't know the science of sex and gender. And I think I was also being watched. So they were watching everything on social media and then kind of reporting it. And I think there were people who weren't necessarily involved directly in the show but were quite close to people in the show who were – in particular, watching very, very closely what I was up to, and in the hope of, getting rid of it. And now, since I've resigned, of course, first thing I say is the thousands upon thousands of people. One of the reasons that I resigned was I thought this isn't the time to hinder your free speech during the rise of the extremism that we're watching.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I had so many people have been in contact who've been fans of the show. And say, we're really going to miss the show, but we're glad you did that. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to do it was, I think an organisation like the BBC is constantly doffing its cap to extremists from Tufton Street and not aware that the majority of their listeners do not hold the opinions that they're being told. And you know, on the last show we did, It was a beautiful venue in Manchester. It was the NIA or something like that, and a beautiful old theatre where Nina Simone used to play a lot. And when the producer got up, who's someone that I like a great deal, I like a producer, she said, do you want to sit down? Actually, I am going to have to say something, because I thought I can't leave the final episode without mentioning it. So I just made a bit of a kind of, you know, speech about it. And my friend afterwards said that everyone was in support, because they don't hold these hatreds that apparently appear to be self-evident.
Yeah.
Really aren't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see that with the, yeah, I think you see that, you know, the Maccabee Tel Aviv ban, which is supposed to be such a scandal. Most British people can see that it was perfectly justified. Yet you never hear a dicky bird about that on the media, I think. And I should also point out that I've only just finished eating that almond croissant. In fact, I've still got bits of almond in my teeth to enjoy. Jesus
Christ. Slowly, those almonds will start to form into the name of the patisserie. And then the smile at the end. Patisserie.
Au pan de papi, you mean? Au pan de papi on the King's Cross Road.
So your departure from that show, shut up, Lex.
I'm not saying, it's not 435 is a lot, but it's a really exceptional almond croissant.
Your departure meant the end of the show.
I don't know. No one's told me. I mean, I said that I was when I resigned in September last year, and I said I was very happy to. We had a show that we were planning to record in January, and the date started to be put in, and I said I would happily do that. Because I also knew Brian was going to be taking a year off anyway. So I said, I thought this was a good time to do it. And they said, no, it would be much better if you just skipped off as soon as possible. Yeah. You've let everyone down.
Jesus. Yeah. So you must have been a bit fucked off.
I am. Do you know what? I'm deeply upset by it. And I can't deny that, because I think the hardest... A while ago, because there was a point where the BBC, I wrote a bit about this in Normally Weird and Weirdly Normal, and you plugged your stop looking to see if there's more almond croissant in there that you left behind. There was a point where my agent had a meeting with me and said some of the executives of the BBC believe you might have a mental health problem, which of course is again, I think either that's been incredibly apparent for 30 years of performing, and why has that come up now? And also I think is a very typical thing that happens in those situations. I know many people who've been whistleblowers. They get to the point where people go, oh, shit, I think they're going to talk, and immediately go, we're very worried about you mentally, actually.
All right, yeah.
But from that point onwards, I think I really was aware of negative voices around me. And I mean, real negative voices, by the way. Now I'm sounding even madder. I was really aware of the voices. You know what I mean? So
it wasn't dogs and cats and stuff.
Yeah. All of the...
and the pottery clowns on the mantelpiece. They're the ones that get me, always telling me to set fire to orphanages.
Yeah, and every time I flush the toilet, I hear Roland Rivron inside my system, just playing the bongos. But the thing that kept me there was that, one, I love making the show, and two, I knew how much people loved the show, and I really, the hardest part of the decision was a sense of betraying those people who listened, because it's like the beautiful thing where there are 10-year-olds who listen and there are people in their 90s who listen, and I get messages from both of those groups, you know, and it's and that was the hardest thing. But again, I just looked at the world as it is now, and I just thought, if a few of us don't at least make some pointless gesture every now and again.
No, solidarity, bro. That's you did the right thing, and it is sad that it's come to this, where you have these fucking fascist voices being amplified and platformed, and then so who's edgy now, you know? Who's edgy? It's the ones getting kicked off the BBC, and we're the fucking lefties, and the ones who are.
Have you ever done that? I mean, presumably that's you done for Live at the Apollo.
I think that was done, for a very long... Josie Long said to me the other day, she said, are we the only two comics who've never been on that? But I think, you know, there is a... That's always what I find funny about this. There's still this peddling of comedy as some left-wing pursuit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the majority of it is, you know, generally anodyne, and most people are very wary of saying anything. Even some of the ones who say they're a bit political will still, I mean, you know, doing the Stand Up for Gaza gigs, it's generally roughly the same people that you're going to be sharing the crisps with.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Robin Romesh versus Interesting Things. I've seen Rob Beckett on that, talking about his tumble, I think it was his tumble dryer, but not in any, not with any like worked out comedy material, but just talking about his tumble dryer.
Yeah, I remember that, I remember watching a comic talk about the annoyance when Pret a Manger don't remind you to take a spoon for your yogurt.
Yeah.
And I felt of the rage in the world. I do know it's annoying to have to drink a yogurt on a busy train, especially if you've got a beard or a moustache. But at the same time, it felt the...
Yeah.
Well, as you said in the article, if Alexi pulls a knife, you pull a gun, said Bobby Ball, polishing his Colt, that there is... you said that... Because this, it turns out this blog is about the feud in 1979 between alternative comedy and mainstream comics and how... There'll only be one winner, and like this is a new breed of comedy. But at the end, you do surmise the comedy world is big enough for all variants.
Yeah,
you know, there's not a one size fits all with comedy. You can't make them all laugh, etc. So the idea that somewhere there must be a comedy that will bring the nation together, like Morecambe and Wise or Hancock, is nonsense. If Hancock was on now, would 30 million tune in? So, like, there is room for everyone, but...
It's just whether they get... I mean, I always find it amazing to see how it's the same faces. So, in fact, if I hope you don't mind, I'm going to do something that's slightly indulgent because a friend of mine died yesterday, and her name was Susan Vale. And Susan was the most fantastic comic and a brilliant... a big fan of The Fool as well. She did Latitude once, where she did a thing called Fool Bingo, where basically people would pick a number and that was attached to a Fool album, and she'd take that out and tell a different story based around each album. There's a lot of Fool albums, right? And she used to tap dance sometimes as well. And she was just really, really funny. But she was always kind of neglected. And I remember doing a gig with her in Manchester once. There were a few of us. And afterwards, when they were dividing up the money, I said, don't forget, Susan's not had any money. And they went, oh, yeah, but that's just Susan. And I thought, no, she's you know, the way that some people just get pushed into this. So I just wanted to mention her because she died yesterday. And she was one of the – I used to write sketches with her and my mate Carl for a Radio 4 show called The In Crowd. And we would just laugh and laugh and laugh. And I think that's one of the things. Sometimes I can feel angry about opportunities I've not had. And then I can also think of people who've not even had, you know, a tiny bit of that kind of, you know, of anything. So if any of you don't know, Susan Vale, she was a very, very funny human being, very, very smart. Deserved far more than she got. And I particularly enjoyed when, I believe, in fact, in one of my books, when she used to dog sit her daughter's angry chihuahua, that made it an even greater joy to stay there because angry chihuahuas are entertaining in their own way.
It's funny, isn't it? Some people just, you know, don't register really. And it's not, I don't know what it is. It's just, you know, it's not lack of talent. It's just they don't.
People I also think Sue was, again, I know I keep mentioning Josie, but I think she was so important. She's someone who doesn't get enough, you know, stuff because she has just that level of not fitting in, which I don't think would have been the problem in 1982, say, you know, when alternate. But now it's like, oh, yeah, but she's a little bit – and you think, but when people go and see her – you know, there are certain acts that you know in some ways kind of help people stay alive.
You know, yes, absolutely.
And I think, you know, the mediocrity where you just go, oh, this blandness, and then you go and you see someone, like I was mentioning, you know, Katrina Dowden or what's she called? I can't believe that I've forgotten her name. Oh, well, don't worry because I've forgotten her name. Do you know that person?
You're going to say, do you know Cornelius Schmuck, and then I'm going to say, no, I don't.
people always leave Josie's shows with their minds blown at how fucking phenomenal she is at putting her art together, putting stories together and constructing these hour-long shows. We've had her on the show here. She's an absolute star. And yeah, so there is room for everyone, but not at the fucking top, I suppose.
No? Do you know Marilyn Robertson?
No.
She's from the Shetland Islands. So immediately means that when she starts talking, it's fascinating because she's got that accent that's kind of Scandinavian and Scottish. And she's an amazing storyteller. I'll just give you this example of one of the shows that she did in Edinburgh, which was during the Fringe, which was she has a condition that means that when she menstruates, she could bleed to death. Right, I think now it's a good handler. That's what she got. Right? A whole show about that.
Jesus.
And I love that before the show started, when everyone was coming in, she just started spraying fake blood onto the stage.
Yeah.
And she said some nights she'd just hear a woman in the front row go, "No, not for me." So they'd literally before it even began. But she is the most amazing storyteller, and proper funny bones. And that's the thing is I look at someone like her, and I always wanted to get her on Monkey Cage as well because I think she studied something like archaeology and when we did mummies and stuff like that. But again, it was that kind of thing of, oh, she's a bit weird. And I was like, well, most of our listeners are a bit weird as well. They really want a bit weird. That's, you know, because it makes them go, we're not the only bit weird people in the world.
I agree. Did Dara O'Brien do astrophysics?
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
Makes me think astrophysics is a lot easier to do than... It's like when Eddie Izzard ran all those marathons. It made me think, I bet I could run a marathon now. Eddie Izzard couldn't run 26 one after another.
Don't do it now. I mean, that idea of the autopsy, them going, he'd have made it as well, but unfortunately, an almond croissant blocked up all his ventricles.
Could you rest in peace, Susan Vale. I'm so sorry for your loss of your friend. She sounds wonderful. Marlene Robertson, I'll keep an eye out. But speaking of self-indulgence, would you mind reading to us that poem that you have about Alexi and you and Josie in the hot tub and all that? I would like Alexi to hear it firsthand.
Stuart Lee hates this poem because it reveals too much about his private life. This was...
And maybe tell us before you start, actually, and then maybe tell us a bit about your transition into poetry in your work.
So basically this was... you're doing the Larm Weekend Festival this year, aren't you, Alexi?
I don't think I am, but... Yeah. I usually do, but I don't think I've been asked this year. I didn't know there was one.
Oh, maybe, yeah, maybe you were. Well, anyway, the Larm Weekend Festival is, I remember one of my favourite times doing that was I was meant to be interviewing Mike Brearley, the England cricket captain and psychotherapist, and I suddenly heard someone going, "Mike Brearley's in London," and he'd been told the wrong weekend. It was 10 minutes before the show. And I've been interviewing Robin Asquith from Confessions of a Window Cleaner and obviously Pasolini's The Canterbury Tales. And and I saw him walk by and I went, "Robin, they're going to cancel the show." But I thought, instead, why don't we take it over? Can I interview you? And I'll only ask the questions I was going to ask Mike Brearley. So Robin Asquith came in and the final question was about, I said, "Now, Wittgenstein, when he died, just before he died, he said, it's been a wonderful life. And John LeMessurier said, it's all been rather lovely." Now, there's a lot of similarities, and I know you work with at least one of those people, and that's how we had a lot of fun. But, yeah, so this was Josie and me were sharing a
I would say Robin is the nicest. We travelled back with him that day or the day after from Larne on the train, and he's just the most – you thought – you we have had so much fun, me, you and him. I never want to see you again.
I think isn't there a picture of all three of us somewhere? I think.
Is there?
Yeah, wow. But when we're out.
That's
outside.
Like, now he's dead. I must try and see if I can get there's a photo of me, Salman Rushdie, and Alan Yentop taken by that Richard Young, that, you know, paparazzi in the 1990s. We look like a kind of Levantine theatre, you know, the three Mustafas. and I know Yentop used to have it in his office, the late Alan Yentop. I could never, and I think, I don't know whether Salman Rushdie ever asked for a copy, but I often asked Richard Young for a copy, but he never would because I didn't have the heft of Alan Yentop. But I'd like, Anybody can find that photo, I'd like a copy of it, really.
Oh, that's
a anyway. Lot. Sorry, Opanda Pappy.
So this was basically Josie when we were sharing one of the little holiday chalets. She went, "Oh my God, there's a jacuzzi there. We'll have to have a jacuzzi tonight." And I said, "I'm not really a jacuzzi person." And then we bumped into Stuart, and Stuart Lee immediately went, "Oh wow, you've got a jacuzzi. Oh, we'll have to get in the jacuzzi then." And I was like, "Oh God." So I did in the end, and this is just called Trotsky Hot Tub. How can this be? Stu and Josie and me all in a jacuzzi. They'll say, "You can't be lefty, too much luxury. Water bubbling like lava and you're swigging carver. Don't you lot want to ban fun?" But as Alexi said, champagne socialism is champagne for everyone.
Very true. That's what we're fighting for. And luxurious almond croissant for the entire proletariat.
I found the picture. Who did you say was with you and Salman Rushdie in the picture?
Alan Yentob, former head of BBC Two.
And David Baddiel, unfortunately.
Oh, that's a later one. No, that's a later iteration.
Okay.
I love the fact that it turns out you've been photobombing Salman Rushdie for years.
That's a gorgeous poem, and you're so fucking good at writing them as well. And they're really snappy and short and great punchlines often. And what's brought on this transition into poetry?
Do you know what? It really was losing my self-loathing, which was kind of...
How'd you do that?
Well,
how'd you leave it on a bench in the Hout Barnhof in Bremerhaven? I left myself loathing.
Well, if your self-loathing drives you, then I think that's... Yeah. So I found out there was a guy called Jamie and Lyon, and he got in contact with me and kind of explained, everyone's got ADHD nowadays. Yeah, anyway, so he explained that I had that, and then I take a bit of anti-anxiety medication. And the combination of the two just now means that I just write all the time. And I'm not, and I don't have to when I do poems, because a lot of my shows now have almost more poetry than anything else. And I don't, in the past, I would have to introduce a poem by going, "Oh, well, I kind of call this a poem, but it probably isn't really a poem. It's probably not a proper poem, and you have to put in all of the things." Whereas now I just think, and I don't care. I care incredibly about every single show, but I don't feel nervous beforehand. And I'm really excited to just kind of, to talk and express different things. And I'm not ashamed. And I feel incredible. That would be one of the reasons that I was able to resign, because in the past, I think, when you can very easily be shut up with your opinions on the world, humanitarian, political, whatever it is, by people going, "Well, actually, you see, there's another," and you go, "Oh, yeah, I am actually very rubbish and I don't really know anything." And obviously having, Brian Cox being very, smart in the world of physics and playing. And now, because I think that was one of the things that went, no, I really do need to, even though I don't want to burn this bridge, I need to, because I do have the confidence to say, I think I need to stand up for this. And I know I'll get some people who will hate me even more, and I know I'll get aggression. It was funny because someone said the first newspaper article about the resignation was the Daily Express, and they said you were very lucky because they hate the BBC more than they hate trans people. They're actually quite pro you.
Take a win where you can get it, right? And what have you got upcoming? Plugs.
Oh, I'm doing I'll be doing the Larm Weekend Festival. When does this go out, by the way?
Day after tomorrow.
Oh, okay. I'll be at Cambridge Junction. I'm doing Cambridge Junction. I'm also going down. I'm doing the old library in Bodmin, and next week, which I'm really looking forward to, with my friend Joanna Neary, who's I don't know if you saw her on Nine Lessons. I can't remember if she was on the night you were on. She's absolutely brilliant. And then I'm doing Falmouth, the Poly in Falmouth, on I think Tuesday the 3rd of February. So that's going to be just a solo show. So I'm kind of going around the place, and my poetry book Ice Cream for a Broken Tooth is out now, and Normally Weird and Weirdly Normal is coming out in paperback, and then there's another poetry book soon called Let the Quiet Ones Rise, which has got probably even more the kind of poetry of kind of different forms of solidarity as well. Because that's one of the things that I love about it, is because I don't have the shame, and because I feel that I can express my love for things and my passion for things. And I don't care if someone goes, oh, that's a bit whimsical, or, oh, isn't that right on? Well, fuck you, I say to them, and I shall continue.
Well, well done. You're well done. A credit to the nation. And we're going to be together on February the 7th at the Slapstick Festival in Bristol, reassessment of the TV series Alexi Sells Stuff. It's sold out, so I don't know what, you know.
But it was...
I'm gratified, so I don't know. There's nothing we can do about that, really. But
The Slapstick Festival is such a lovely thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've been together about, what, 3 years ago, was it? We did it together 3 or 4 years ago.
The Young Ones thing.
But also did a best of as well. We did the you talking about your favourite comedy clips.
Yeah. But also I do every year now. Because the venues are so expensive they do a fundraising benefit, but because venues are so expensive in Bristol, they actually do it in Reading.
Yeah.
At the Reading Hexagon, and I MC it every year. And it was just four comics last year. Just really, there was Stuart, Arthur Smith, I've forgotten, Shazia. Shazia. And that tall red-headed guy from the Northeast with long hair.
Alistair Becker King. He's great. He is. I mean,
yeah, he's really good.
He is. I did a Just Stop Oil benefit with him, and his opening line was, I'm not here because I support the cause. I'm here because I hate the paintings of Van Gogh. What a fantastic opening line.
Yeah. Brilliant. He's very good.
Can I get a quick plug in, please? Actually, I have something to plug that we need to sell tickets to. Do you mind, Alexi, sir?
Can I plug a show? Well, I do, but I'm going to pretend. Go on.
Thank you, Daddy. On the 13th of February, which is my birthday, annoyingly, I'm going to be in Leicester. Not annoyingly. Leicester Comedy Festival with my improv team called The Bazaar. We're Europe's first Middle Eastern North African improv team, and we're actually good. I promise. The Bazaar presents Arabian Nights Live at the Little Theatre in Leicester as part of the Leicester Comedy Festival. Go to comedy-festival.co.uk and look for The Bazaar. And please get a ticket and come say hi.
Oh, yeah, I'm doing the Leicester Comedy Festival on the 17th of February as well, which is 3 days before my birthday.
Oh, we're both Aquariuses, which doesn't matter.
Oh, no, I'm just on the cusp.
Oh, okay, good. That's
fine. I always get Brian Cox to do me astrological.
Get out of my star sign. Oh, yeah. All right, I think that about does it, unless you've got anything else to plug.
No, thank you, Robin. As always, it's been an absolute pleasure and a hayride, a roller coaster ride of don't know where it's going to go next. A roller coaster ride that's become detached from its roller coaster and is hurtling through the countryside.
Oh, that's nice.
Taking down pomposity and anger and rage as it careens. I don't know.
Thank you, Robin.
See you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Panda Papi.
Oh, I mentioned this as well because you mentioned Shazia. Yeah. We're also screening at Slapstick South Park, Bigger, Longer, Uncut.
Oh, amazing.
And South Park's takedown on Trump at the moment. I don't know if you've seen it.
I don't really watch South Park. Well, I think you'll really enjoy this one.
So Trump gets Satan pregnant. Satan has the tiniest arsehole. They deliberately made it tiny so nothing could get into it. But Trump's penis is so small it was able to get into his arsehole. And J.D. Vance is basically Herb Villechaize from Fantasy Island. And its childishness, I know, will genuinely annoy those kind of but it is angry Satan being made pregnant by Donald Trump masturbating with a pair of tweezers is great fun.
Impregnated in his bum. On that note, Alexi.
On that note, yeah. We'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
See you on the 7th. You've been listening to the Alexisel podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.